Social Sessions is a forum for discussing social-emotional wellness and safety issues in education. Amanda Rodenberg, we are so excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You are a rock star in this community.
Thanks.
You're doing great work, and Outright's an amazing organization. So I got a million questions. The first is maybe what is Outright?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll start with that one. What is Outright Vermont?
Yeah, great. So Outright Vermont is the LGBTQ youth serving organization for the entire state.
It's so good. Nonprofit, not for profit?
Nonprofit.
Yeah, okay. So you're funded through donations and events you hold and the like.
Yep, a good mix of donors who are very generous, of events that do fairly well, and of state foundations, federal grants, a pretty solid mix.
You have like a milestone birthday that either just happened or is happening for the organization.
Yeah, so Outright turns 30 this year.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
30!
Yeah.
So good.
We're older by far than all of our youth.
That's awesome. As such, interesting. I didn't think about that. You're right. Yeah. At some point. You kind of make that crossover.
Yeah.
And it started here, I think you mentioned, in Burlington. And what was the core service offering and kind of where did it go from there?
Yeah, so Outright Vermont was founded by 6 members, and it was started as a hotline and a Friday night group. So Friday night group in Burlington has met every Friday night, no matter what, since 1989.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. And are any of the, like, the first group of youth that were part of it, is there a legacy in terms of relationships? Do you have folks that have been working the organization for years and was a part of it as a youth and now work with it as a volunteer or staff? Or?
Yeah, it's actually, the Outright family is really far-reaching in really lovely and surprising ways. So Representative Bill Lippert was one of our founders.
He's
still a volunteer with us.
He's unbelievable.
We work with him frequently. Keith Gosling was one of our founders. He's also
Keith.
In the community.
Keith used to teach for me when I ran the Police Academy training program. I would bring Keith in to talk about LGBTQ issues in the community and help educate law enforcement.
Yep.
And we will tell stories when we're not on air about the things that Keith would bring. I'll just say this. The things that Keith would bring to the Police Academy with him to show the Police Academy recruits would turn them all shades of red and purple.
Oh, yeah,
which I thought
that
was the best thing ever. So
a growing opportunity.
Oh my gosh, one of my favorite people.
The Outright Youth alum that comes to top of mind is DJ Craig Mitchell.
Oh sure. So good.
Yeah.
So this and by now the organization's alumnus or alumni, whatever the way you say that, must be all over the country. I mean, you must have gone far and wide, if not the world. I mean,
yeah.
Just a lot of people have come through the organization.
Yeah.
And you're more than Burlington now. You're meeting all over the state.
Yeah, so Friday Night Group has programs that meet in Burlington still, Montpelier, Morrisville, Brattleboro, and we just started in Middlebury. Yep.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Doing really good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have to ask you, I heard this term, and I need to understand what it means, because as I've said to you before, and we'll say again, you know, I hope you'll take full license to correct me in any way that I should. What is a rainbow sheep? I think that's the best. I think it evokes an image that I love. I just like, it's a rainbow sheep.
Well, it's a joke for me in that I come from a fairly large family. I've got sisters, I've got a younger stepbrother, and in my mom's extended family and my dad's extended family, I am the only one, so I am the rainbow sheep of the
family.
You
are the rainbow. Now, you are the only one who has maybe come out or come forward.
Yes, that's
right,
true.
Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You're the rainbow
just
sheep.
Just paving the way for the rest
of
them.
I think that's awesome. I really think that's a funny way to like characterize that. That's
yeah.
Good, rainbow sheep. You make me think, as I'm reflecting on your comments, that something I just watched the documentary on Dr. Ruth Westheimer on Hulu. There's a Hulu documentary on Ruth Westheimer. It was fascinating. You know, she was an Israeli army sniper at one point in her career. I just
turned sexual health educator.
Unbelievable. Like I did. That was a whole exactly. One of the things that she was quoted as saying in the documentary, but of course she said it a million times, is that there is no normal. Everyone's normal, right? So what it makes me reflect on in terms of what you're saying is that the systems have put artificial pressure, or not no, real pressure, in creating artificial constraints, in the sense of it's not the youth that are members or identify as being members of the LGBTQ community that have to figure out, how to be in the world in a way that they can be accepted, but they are normal. It's the constraints of the systems around them
yes.
that isn't normal.
Yes. If you are going to the doctors and they hand you a form to fill out, an intake form you've never been before, and they say male or female, and you're a non-binary trans kid, that's an experience of stress.
And you're instantly isolated.
You're instantly isolated. You instantly don't know what will happen if you tell your healthcare provider who you actually are, how they're going to respond to that. You don't know if they're going to connect you to gender-affirming services or if they're going to misgender you and use your legal name through the entire visit, right? Like, so it's a, there's a level of risk involved.
Everything is stress.
Everything is stressful.
Everything is stressful.
And so then you self-medicate, you self-harm,
you, it's like you don't
feel
get a break.
Isolated.
No. And so the Friday night groups allow a place where you can come and get a break.
You can get a break.
While you're trying to figure out how to be who you are in a place which you're normal and everything around you isn't normal.
And you are talking to youth who have gone through similar things or are going through similar things.
Sure.
You can learn who their doctor is, if it's been a good or bad experience for them. You can
sure.
hear that there is advocacy you can do in your school to make the teachers respond to your preferred name instead of your legal name, right?
Sure.
So there's all these points of connection and activism that happen within this tiny group. It's really special.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Man, it's a great organization. One of the things that I've come to appreciate about the work you're doing and have done is this idea that you're working with, you know, individual youth, meeting them where they are in their journey and trying to, as they try and navigate the complexities of the world around them in light of its acceptance of them. You mentioned something around the idea of minority stress theory. I just would love to understand that better. I'm sure there are, you know, school leaders all over the country who are going to want to understand what that is and then maybe how it affects them and their understanding of supporting the students in their community that identify with the LGBTQ.
Yeah, so the original study was done looking at the experiences of bisexual and gay men. And what the study found was that these men who are navigating the world with a marginalized identity, with a minority identity, were disproportionately likely to experience chronic stress, which led to a whole host of risk behaviors and outcomes, including experiences of chronic stress, self-medication, substance use, an increase in smoking that we see in the LGBT community. And so it really helps speak to the way that the inherent outcomes, that the outcomes that we're seeing in the LGBT community are not inherent to identity, that it's inherent to the way that you are forced to navigate a world that tells you that you're bad or wrong or off or other. And so I see that play out in the experiences of youth when I hear from parents who say things like, well, I won't let my kid be trans because there's a really high rate of suicide in
that
community.
They won't let them, right.
And that's not how that works.
No. Just to be clear to everyone watching this, that is not how that works.
Right. And what I can hear in that is concern for the safety of your kid, and we can build from that. I'm on board. And what that serves to do when you try to force a kid to be someone who they're not, the work of Dr. Caitlin Ryan and the Family Acceptance Project demonstrates clearly that high rates of family rejection can increase a youth's risk of experiencing suicide over their lifetime up to 8 times more than youth who experience even very low level of rejection because it's so isolating and harmful. Mm-hmm. And low level of rejection is still not the same as acceptance, celebration.
No, it's still rejection.
It's still rejection, right. But even very low rejection to very high rejection has a hugely disproportionate outcome for LGBT youth, which is so sad and also hopeful because there's prevention in that, right? We can work with families to mitigate their reactions when youth are coming out to them to decrease the level of harm that youth experience and improve their outcomes.
Sure. Just as I'm listening, I'm thinking, you know, they're experiencing it at the personal micro level in terms of everyday interactions. And then you look at some of the national discussions about gay rights and such, and it compounds that some exponential fold.
Yes, that's so fascinating because before marriage equality was the law of the land, another research study was being done on the relation between youth suicide rates in the states where marriage equality laws were being passed when it was going state by state. And what they found was that youth suicide rates in states that passed marriage equality were being reduced by almost 10%.
Really?
And it's not because 16-year-olds are knocking down the doors of City Hall to get married. No. It's because you could start to picture a future where you could live the life that you wanted to live. And right. so even the impact of macro-level policy and decision-making has a huge impact on the direct lived experiences sure. of very young people.
Sure. And how... The way you say that, I think it opened up additional thinking for me, this idea that they could see a future for themselves.
Yes.
One supported in the community, in the workplace, with the laws and the... and I know from my own experience with members of my own family, the struggles they had with the lack of that equality and what that did around rights to health care, rights to survivorship, rights to medical issues. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it was... a mess in every way, shape, and form. And so I think, I mean, I like the way you said that, a future that they could see themselves in. So what, so you're working day to day with youth that are in need of services that you're providing. What are those services and what are you, like, tell us more about how you're personally influencing through the organization, the work you're doing with kids.
Yeah, so youth. So the idea is that youth get to connect to their peers. So everyone at Friday Night Group is LGBTQ, queer, trans, or questioning, mm-hmm. Including the adults who facilitate it. So the idea is that youth not only get to be in a room full of LGBT peers, but they also get to connect to LGBT adults to start that work of being able to envision a future with you in it.
So good.
Yeah.
Mentoring, coaching, connecting. I like that
yeah.
a lot.
So that's our... that's our flagship program, and since then we've grown into a really robust set of services. So we look at a few spheres for intervention. One is connecting youth to a sense of authentic self, and that is built through peer connection, through exploration, through being celebrated in their identity.
Yeah.
We are the place that youth come to try out their new name. So they'll sit in Friday Night Group and say, I'm using this name now. Everyone calls me this. And everyone just does it. And that happens in very few spaces in their lives.
It's got to be so emotional.
It's so
like
good.
I'm sitting here thinking as you're talking, I'm getting emotional about it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's got to be an incredible experience for someone who's struggling to find a place in the world and who hasn't felt accepted, to be able to walk into this organization and be with people who take them for who they are and take that stress off their shoulders for that yeah. period of time. It's got to be it's got to be incredible.
It's incredible.
Maybe I come work with you. I think maybe I'm going to, I don't know, maybe I got to see if you get a part-time job or a full-time
We're
job for me.
We're going to be hiring, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. So what else? So there are other yeah. things, yeah.
Yep, so we run a week-long residential summer camp called Camp Outright that we're planning for now. It's going to happen in August. We bring about 70 youth for this week of programming, and it's a mixture of a traditional summer camp experience with a queer and rainbow twist. So we have everything from like swim time and archery and cabins with no electricity or heat to...
classic Vermont kind of camping
yeah.
experiences.
But we throw in some Drag 101, queer history.
So the Friday night talent show is a little different?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the best.
The model stands.
Right.
So it's a really, really special week. And it's exactly what you're saying where, you know, in the rest of their world, youth often have to mute their authentic selves in order to make the people around them accept them or more comfortable or to steer away from experiences of violence or harm. And so when they come to Camp Outright, they're 150% themselves here's a space where you can change your name and pronouns every day and we don't care, we'll roll with it. And so for them to be able to have that exploration and the space to really dig into who they want to be and how they want to navigate the world with the support of the community is special.
It's like I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, trying to empathize, how exhausting it has to be every day to live your life not who you think you are, who you are, mm-hmm. so that you can satisfy someone else.
Yes.
You know, and it's survival in every way, shape, and form.
Yes.
Both, it could be both physical survival as well as emotional and mental.
Yes, and even economic, because in many states in this country, you can still be fired for being LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about, and the largest employer in the country has just been directed not to accept trans members into the military service. And so if I'm thinking about how to impact, change, and help youth envision a future, I'm going to need policies to help me get on board with that.
It feels like it could be overwhelming. So I like a couple of thoughts that come out. So how do you personally keep your spirits and your, you know, attitude. What needs to do? You're doing difficult work. You're with people every day who are struggling. So what do you do to kind of keep yourself, you know, tied into the optimistic side of what's going on?
Yeah, I actually don't find that to be super hard. And whenever I am really struggling with the weight of the work, it's usually because I haven't spent much time with youth lately.
So that's where you get your energy. So that wasn't the right question. You know,
well, a lot of the third tier of the work that we do, aside from individuals and peer connections and community, is looking at how we change systems. And so we do a lot of professional development work in schools. We're working with a lot of state partners to help help them create systems that are more supportive of LGBT youth.
So you're going from, I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, is that the individual experiences that you are working with and you are shaping and understanding and supporting translate into larger or illustrate larger systemic issues.
Yes.
So what does that look like? Tell us more about what that link is and how the organization and how the work you're doing is helping to, you know, tackle that. Like, what do we want to learn from that?
Yeah, so one place, the direct correlation I can look at is I was working with a lot of youth who were involved with the Department for Children and Families and the foster care system. So we know nationwide that homeless and runaway youth, 40% of them are likely to be LGBTQ, which is a disproportionately high. A huge rate for that community.
Staggeringly so.
And so they're also disproportionately likely to be involved with family services of some kind. And so I was working with youth who had case managers, who were in foster care, who were looking at adoption, and that system wasn't quite sure how to support LGBT youth. So residential services would be licensed to work with males or females. And so trans youth were being housed with people who didn't share their gender identity and were being misgendered within their own supportive programs. Programs that were supposed to be supportive.
That's a problem.
On
many levels.
They had case managers navigating internal systems that needed their legal name and biological marker. And so every time you got a new case manager, you'd have to come out again if you felt safe doing that and re-explain it and navigate that again.
Multiple potential victimizations in that experience.
Or you just give up because you don't want to have to do that again with another person and you're not sure how they're going to react. Right. And maybe your experience will be detrimental to your overall wellness because you need them to know what's going on with your foster family, but you can't come out to them because they might not listen to you about what's happening after that.
So you don't feel safe.
So I started work with the Department for Children and Families to help them create a policy to direct the workforce for how to support LGBT youth. It's called Policy 76. We're about 2 years in now. And it served a few functions. It helped direct residential programs that they could in fact support youth based on their gender identity and not their sex assigned at birth, which was a huge shift.
Big.
It directed a workforce that not allowing youth to access gender affirming medical care was not a neutral option, that the experience of rejection and harm was so increased if that kind of service was denied that it actually was causing more harm. And so in the spirit of serving youth, they stopped telling youth that they needed to wait until they aged out of the program, that they could start looking at who your medical provider could be and what sort of services you could access from them in a more holistic way, which was really important.
Wow.
And it also gave directives for incorporating a preferred name and pronoun within the system and including in case notes and in court documents and this part is really important, with youth direction. So we require case managers to talk to youth about who they are, what name they want to be referred to as, and who that's safe to do with. So if you're a kid who is trans and you want your case manager to use a new name for you, the case manager needs to assess with you whether that happens just here in this office between us, whether you want that reflected in your case notes and who might see those, whether you want that in the court documents where your bio family might see it and whether or not it's safe for that to happen. And so youth get to be in the driver's seat of their own information in a way that's really new and awesome.
And they get to feel they have some control.
Yeah.
In a world where they may not always feel like they have a lot of control.
Yeah. And so my work has looked a lot like how to infuse trauma-informed practices like giving survivors control over their own narrative and stories into the work that we do at Outright and the way that it's reflected out into the community.
You got me, thinking, for all the years that I was part of educating the public safety community on gender and sexual violence, one of the things that we would often use as an exercise is, you know, how many times does a survivor tell his or her story, you know, and whom do they tell it to? And you begin to look at, you know, somewhere in the north of 25, 30 times in the system between they tell the first officer, then the second officer, and then they tell the prosecutor, then they have to tell the judge. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and it wears you down is the message we got, you know, from survivors. They said it's a disincentive for us to want to, you know, want to move forward. We become reluctant. So it's like an eye-opening as I listen to you talk about giving youth who are experiencing, you know, a marginalized, you know, living life and having been pushed to the fringes in many ways, some control back is incredible.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
It's good
stuff. No wonder why you like to do this.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we do, you know, Social Sentinel's mission is not really. You know, the safety and security of our youth, of our schools, of our universities, colleges, and K-12 school districts. That's really where our passion is. And part of our service, our service looks at that climate around safety and security and wellness. And we've been very deliberate about how we include the search for harm around homophobia and racism and anti-Semitism and the like. You've got me thinking deeply about, are we doing enough in the way we construct our library and what we're looking for and how we're doing it? Because given what you've said and what you've educated me on, if the LGBTQ community is that much more at risk, then statistically they would be showing up in our service, you know, as potential indicators of their own harm as such more than maybe any other group would. Mm-hmm. And you got me thinking about, gee, I think I may have a part-time job for you. You know, you may not want another part-time job, but I think you've just got me thinking about what that looks like. Because, you know, today's youth, nearly all of them communicate digitally. I mean, you know, I'm in my 50s. I'm a digital immigrant. I had to learn how to use technology. Our kids, I mean, my teenage children are digital natives.
That's seamless, yeah.
All they know.
Yeah.
And what I often find when I'm talking to other folks, you know, maybe my age or older, is that they don't always connect with, well, why would someone post something like that? Well, because it's an extension of your brain if you only know digital conversations,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, pictures are it never happens.
Right, absolutely. So a lot of thinking around that being the case, then a lot of that leakage of harm is going to disproportionately come from members of the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
And are we doing enough to understand that?
Yeah.
Because that's part of why you're here, but, you know, just in the conversation.
When I approached the work with DCF, one of the first sort of opening conversations that we had before the policy was, you know, even thought of, one person said, well, I don't know why we're undertaking this kind of work. We don't even know that we have that many of these kind of youth.
This was somebody not connected with the organization.
Not with Outright.
Right.
Yeah.
Who, really.
And so, but that's the understanding that folks have. And it's true too that I've heard similar remarks from school-based personnel. So a parent called very upset because the school that their kid was in had done a health unit. The only time LGBT identity had come up was in the HIV AIDS unit.
Ugh.
And when the parent said, that's really messed up, the teacher responded, well, we don't really have that problem here. And so...
Oh, there's a whole bunch of things wrong with that statement. First of all, it's not a problem. Second of all, guess what? It's actually here.
And if youth think that that is going to be the response from the adults around them...
Why are they going to share?
Of course they're not going to tell you.
Say a word.
Of course that's why you don't know that you have youth here, because you have that attitude and they're not going to tell you.
And so you end up You know, so then you end up, that's the other part of your job. So when it looks, as I think I understand it, when you're looking at the youth, it's the intellectual, physical, emotional support that gives them a safe place mm-hmm. to be who they are and needs to be. And then when it comes to the rest of the community, it's that conversation about, can I respectfully help you understand where you may be wrong? And sometimes I'm guessing you're doing it right in their face, and other times you have to be a little more diplomatic about it, right, to get that point across. But that's got to be exhausting as well. That's a chipping away at something that's overwhelming.
Yeah. And I found that the most impactful times we're able to do that is when we can be the conduit for youth to say directly to the adults who are impacting their lives. And so how can we, oftentimes we create panels or opportunities for youth to take the lead in some of the education work.
Yeah. They hear directly from the youth.
Yes.
That's powerful.
We have a really awesome program called Leadership Day, where we take, this year is about 110 youth and faculty advisors to the State House. We have a whole day of learning how to advocate. They testify in committee hearings. They do a Q&A with a panel of out legislators on the Hill. It's really, really awesome.
Wow.
And one thing that we've seen is that, you know, legislators show up in droves to hear directly from youth. And so one year, years ago now, our youth were like, it's really hard for us to use public restrooms, and that is a problem. It causes a lot of harm. Fast forward, I think it passed 2, maybe 3 years ago now, the legislature was able to hear that, create legislation. Representative Bill Lipper was instrumental in it. So with his help and with direct communication from Outright Youth, they were able to pass a law that said public restrooms need to be accommodations for everybody. And you need, if you have a single-use restroom, it has to be ungendered.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I remember when the university went through the process in the buildings, and I was the chief of police at the time, and we were moving through, and I remember both the swell of advocacy and yes, and then I remember the swell of what? We're not doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was acutely aware of how isolating those conversations must have been for the members of the LGBTQ community who were like, here we go again, right? I mean, just here we go again.
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing. Yeah, Vermont, we've done some good stuff in this state, haven't we?
Good stuff, yeah.
I know, it's good, right? It's good. What is there about the work you're doing and the efforts underway that I haven't asked you about that you really want to make sure that people know? Because there's folks all over the country who are going to be watching this who are going to be asking themselves, are we doing enough?
Mm.
Are we stepping up to the right ways? Are we... You know, what do we want to make sure that they hear from you?
Yeah. The thing I've seen be most impactful for the experience of harm that youth are facing is the presence of one supportive adult. So one supportive adult in a youth's life can drastically decrease their likelihood of suicidal ideation, can give them a person to go to if they're experiencing harm in their relationship, can give them someone to talk to if they don't have the right resources around healthy sexuality, gives them a person. And so when I think about the authentic connections I've had with adults as a young person, they were so much based around the adult being curious about what was going on with me. About hearing what I was saying without immediately offering advice from, you know, a very adulty on high perspective, but really just being present with my experience and then being able to offer resources or opportunities that reflected what I was saying. And so that is the work that I try to carry through with youth. I'm listening to the things that they're telling me. I'm reflecting that back. So if a youth wants to talk to me about their girlfriend, I'll talk about their girlfriend with them as long as they want to. But I don't make the leap from, you told me you have a girlfriend, so therefore you are a lesbian, right? Like,
It's not that dichotomous.
It's not that dichotomous.
It's much more complex than that.
Right. And so I'm listening very carefully to exactly what they are saying, and then I'm reflecting that back to them to show that I'm listening, right? These are advocate tricks that the anti-violence movement has incorporated for decades that adults just need to get on board with. It's the right thing to do. Yeah.
I hope that the adults in your life when you were that you point to that you're clearly emulating. Like I get the sense that you had some good experiences with people who listened, or at least experiences that taught you the way to do it, the way that it needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And it looks like you're passing that on, which I think is meaningful. Like I hope those adults, I hope they're watching. I hope whoever you are, you're watching this conversation, because this is really good. You did good, right? And I hope that all the kids, the youth, not mm-hmm. kids, I gotta correct myself there, that are watching, just appreciate how thoughtful you are as to what that looks like. Mm-hmm. I get asked all the time, what's the, you know, I've been working in school safety for a long time, you know, whether it was the chief at the university, chief of police, or whether it was the consulting I did in this company and the former company. And I get asked all the time, what's the key to a safe school? And I always say it's not the alligators and the moats and the door locks mm-hmm. and the all that stuff is, yeah, okay, if you need it. It's every youth knowing there's one adult in the school who will listen to them and is there for them.
Yes.
That's it. That's the secret to doing it right.
There was a study, I'm not going to remember the exact specifics around it, but it was a story that's really stuck with me and the approach I take with youth. I think it was a school in Texas, did an exercise in there with their entire staff and administration where they put all of the names of the kids up on the wall. And if you as an adult in that building could call that kid by name, could recognize them outside of school and call them by name, and you knew one thing that they were really interested in, you could put a star by their name. And so the adults all did the exercise, and a lot of kids had more than one star, and some kids had no stars. And at the end, they looked at the kids who had the most stars, and those were their top performing kids. And they looked at the kids that had no stars, and those were the kids that were really struggling. And what they...
That's a really good research story.
What they strategized was that their new mission was to build those connections with youth. Like, your mandate is to go make a connection with a youth who had no star. You learn their name, you learn to recognize them, and you find out one thing about them. Those kids started doing better.
Oh, this is so good.
Their attendance went up. Their grades went up. I mean, so then you need one supportive adult.
So, and then here you are, Amanda, making that connection to a youth in the community, mm-hmm. one-on-one. You know their name. You know what's important to them. You know where they're struggling. You know where they're succeeding. Mm-hmm. And you're listening and being a part of that conversation and being present. And you're making that difference in their lives. And because of the work you're doing and Outrage is doing, they will grow up, hopefully, to have inner strength and resolve to be able to survive some of the challenges they'll face. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what you're doing with Outright is giving the youth that you work with the ability, and I liked what you said, they can see a future because they can relate to. So you're giving them access to adults and other people who might look like them, sound like them, think like them, who are like them. So what was that like in your life? What was that? What did that look like with you growing up?
Yeah. So I graduated high school with a class of 39 other students. So
small rural?
Small and right? rural. There was nobody out in my high school. That was not a thing that was present. And there were, you know, some kids we would whisper about, but nobody really knew. And I had the joy of working with two women who were business partners and life partners. As a summer job in high school and into college. And I just remember, I would always say things like, oh, I just really want that type of relationship. You know, I'm not that way, but you know, I really like that type of relationship where you're engaging with the roles that fit you best because it's who you are and not because it's expected of you. And I really enjoy your connection with one another. It seems really authentic. And I had all this admiration for it, but I never identified with it because I didn't know that queer women could look like me, could also be very feminine, could also, you know, there's this stereotype around what lesbians look like or right. what bi women look like, and it's all very, like...
Stereotypical.
And so, and there's a moment that I remember, I'm sorry, Mom, in the car with my mom and my two older sisters, and my mom said, well, thank goodness we made it through puberty and none of you are gay. And I just remember thinking, oh... Yeah, that would have happened by now if it were supposed to happen for me. Like, I wouldn't, you know, there's the story of, like, I knew since I was 7, but I didn't tell anybody. And I think that is true for a lot of people.
Not
and
for also everyone.
Not for
it's
everyone.
It's a narrative that boxes, again, constraints.
Yeah.
It's not a, right.
Yeah, so the narrative of heteronormativity is you look a certain way, you behave a certain way, you date a certain way, and you don't deviate from that, and especially if you don't have representation, if you can't see our executive director Dana talks about seeing mirrors, windows, and doors. So mirror is when you can see yourself reflected in your community. A window is being able to look out and imagine possibilities that you didn't know existed before, and a door is being able to access that future that you want for yourself.
I like that analogy.
And I didn't have any of those things, you know, when I was growing up, and so it took me many more years to be able to explore an authentic sense of self that did include queerness, that did include bisexuality.
Where did you find it? Where did you feel like you began to find that?
I had graduated college and I had given myself some really intentional space for not dating anybody. And that was when I had the time and space to really explore who I wanted to be and not just who other people expected me to be.
Yeah. How do you think the experience, and I'm going to make a presumption, you may correct me on this, which I hope you do if I need to be corrected.
Yeah.
How do you make, the presumption that what do you think is different between the lesbian experience in this way, the gay experience in this way, the trans experience in this way? Are there definitive commonalities, and yet are each of those communities within the larger LGBTQ community experiencing very differently how they come to terms with accepting who they are, maybe in terms of artwork, but how do they accept who they are? What does that look like? I mean, you had an experience as a queer woman who identifies in a certain way, who looks a certain way, all the things you talked about. And there are, my guess is, some of that experience translates to every part of the overall community, but then some of that experience is different, right? So do you see those differences in the youth? I mean, am I looking at the right way, or am I trying to create artificial, you know, separations?
No, well, what I think I hear you saying is that that LGBTQ is a huge umbrella that covers a whole host of, you know, sexual identities and gender identities.
Big.
And everybody has both.
Big.
You know, it's not the trans community also has sexual identity. We tend to focus on their gender identities because that is what is so flashy and you know, causes the most
maybe
attention
in your face as much because it stands out maybe more.
Well, and I think it stands out because the system has been set up to squelch that, right? So not as though trans people are trying to be in your face, but that
everything else around them, it's like everyone take a step back and then who's standing
right. Well, we've ingrained gender in so many systems in the way that you navigate your day to day that it becomes impossible to not think about your experience of gender if it doesn't match the mold of what you're supposed to be walking through the world with. And so for me as a cisgender, cis means same. And so I was assigned female at birth. I still identify as a woman. I'm a cisgender woman. As a cisgender woman, I don't have to worry about what type of facilities the restaurant I want to go to dinner is going to have for me.
There's a women's room for you and it's going to be accessible.
And nobody's going to question if I use it. And in fact, my privilege is so deep that even if I use the men's room, it's a little bit like the line was shorter, right? Like, I don't have to worry that people are going to
feel threatened
hurt me and threaten me because I've used a bathroom that does not correspond to my gender identity, right? It doesn't matter what
and you're not wearing
I'm using.
Someone who meets you doesn't know that part of who you are by looking at you in what they would stereotype what that means.
Yes, and that has caused some very interesting conversations. So when I was at Voices, we partnered with a program that helps do employment services for the elder community, and so we had a really lovely receptionist who we were working with for a few months. And I had put this deck of postcards out to advertise for Pride. It's the queer celebration in town happens in September. And she picks it up and she looks at it and she's like, what's this for? And I was like, well, it's for Pride Parade. It's to celebrate the LGBT community in Vermont. And she throws it away from herself. She's like, ugh, ugh. And like, has this disgusted look. And she, I said, oh.
Well, here's an opportunity. You thought, well, here we go. This is going to be a great opportunity.
We're going to talk about that. And it was twofold, right? She was the receptionist for an organization that serves all survivors. And so my first comment was, listen, anybody who needs our help needs to be able to call and say what is going on for them, and they cannot get that from you, no matter what they say.
That's bad on so many levels.
It's bad on so many levels.
They have the courage to pick up the phone and reach out for help, and then the people they reach out to, isolate them.
You're the gatekeeper for our organization.
So not good.
I need you to get that under control. And also, you should know that I'm queer.
And that had to be a whole other conversation. She must have been like, yeah.
But it was helpful because we had worked together for months. We had a great rapport. She liked me a lot. I liked her a lot. And so here was a really great moment where she thought she knew everything she needed to know about the LGBT community.
And about you. And she
and
made
about
assumptions.
Me, and she did not know.
How important was, I mean, so I'm just thinking, the what a gift you gave her, because you opened her eyes to some ignorances and some assumptions that I hope she was intelligent enough to absorb and say, this is life, you know, altering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think to the point that we've been talking about, I there are many members of my family who identify as part of the LGBT community, and I would, you know what, I worked at the university for so many years. It was LGBTQA. It went through much. So I kind of, whenever I'm saying it, I'm hitting like six different places at once to get it the way I think it needs to be. So the LGBTQ community, and they didn't, and they don't to this day meet the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with very masculine gay men,
mm-hmm.
right? I didn't grow up with whatever the other side of that is, whatever that gets defined as.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was important, I think, in shaping my identity around what that means. And I think having the opportunity to be able to look at you and have a conversation with you and have you say, you know, I have privilege, when there are other members of that larger community that don't have that privilege, and it's got to be painful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every day, even more so.
Mm-hmm.
You can now, I mean, I'm a large white male. I can navigate all kinds of scenarios, and it's not, you know, I can be stomping on all kinds of issues that I'm not aware of as a result.
Mm-hmm.
This is very powerful stuff you're doing.
Mm.
You know, it made me also think of, you know, when I was doing a lot of work in helping, in part around sexual and gender violence, we would talk to both, you know, men and women in a room talking about the experiences, and I would ask the men in the room, how many times a day do they think about their personal safety?
Mm.
Now, I'm asking men who I presume, given the setting we've set, are hetero men, right, who don't identify as being out. Now, very realistic that a large part of that population may have identified with the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
And the men in the room, when I would ask, you know, how many of you think, you know, almost not. No one's thinking about it. Then I would ask the women in the room, how many times a day do you think about your personal safety? And it was when I get up in the morning, when I walk into the bathroom, when I brush my teeth, when I'm thinking about who's the door, when I'm thinking, it's exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And as I listen to you, I layer on top of that the safety around being a part of the LGBTQ community. What does that look like?
Right. And the analysis that the community so often has to do around emotional safety versus physical safety. My emotional safety might mean dressing the way that I want to dress when I go to school, and that might impact my physical safety when others perceive that the things that I want to wear don't match the sex I was assigned at birth. And so how do we help youth navigate, how do we help recreate a world that has been set up to cause them harm so that they can go about their lives?
They can be who they are.
Yeah.
About 20 years ago, an FBI researcher, agent, I actually don't know what she did at the Bureau, then she may have been an agent, did the primary research on what's called leakage.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that when you started with youth, it was school focused, kids, it's now everyone, but youth talk about doing bad things before they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called leakage. It was the idea that, you know, a note found or a comment made or, you know, a journal entry about self-harm or harm against others. And one of the things that Well, the reason Social Sentinel exists is because we try to identify the leakage, you know, before it turns into, evidence of something having happened, you know, as a, in a preventative model. And one of the things you've got me thinking a lot about is, you know, we have put effort into understanding homophobia and anti-Semitism and racism, but let's talk about homophobia. And is homophobia a term that encompasses the trans community as
transphobia.
Well?
Transphobia.
Yeah, it's transphobia, because I knew it doesn't.
Yeah.
All right, so it's homophobia and transphobia,
yeah.
Right? I'm going to make a note of that because I want to make sure we're using the right language on that. That we're doing enough in the homophobia and transphobia in terms of how our system identifies, but I'm thinking maybe we're not doing enough. I mean, maybe there's probably always more to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and we're out looking for the leakage. And what I hear you saying is we want to support the community, the LGBTQ community, so that that indication of or the prevalence of them harming themselves, you know, we can deal with that. And we're a company looking for signs of that. You know, it's like we're...
Yeah. And it's so funny to, you know, as I hear you sort of list them out, and we do it all the time, you know, racism, sexism. When we get to homophobia and transphobia, it's suddenly a phobia and not an ism, right? Like, I'm arachnophobic. I hate
Great
spiders.
Point.
And so I see a spider in the shower and I'm like, and I jump out. And that's not what's happening here, right? Like, that's
totally
not
true.
So what's, queer people,
right? So what is the language is powerful, right? Noam Chomsky, the words we use to think with and speak with. What's the right word?
But I don't think I have one. But the reason I note it, and especially in the work that you're doing, is because I think it's there are many places in the country where you can use a type of defense that talks about, well, I was so afraid of this queer person that I couldn't.
I was afraid, so
myself.
I had to right.
Exactly, right. I had to cause the harm because I was so caught up in how disturbing it was for me to see a person with a beard and a dress. And so I think so often about the way that we've constructed the way we approach LGBT community to allow for more leeway in your emotional and visceral response to that community as a cisgender heterosexual person.
I that is really powerful. That's a big insight for me.
Yeah.
That's a metanoia for me, a shifting of the mind. That's phobia, you're right. Huh. All right, so now I'm going to ponder on that. I'm going to just keep coming back to you. We're going to have these sessions on a regular basis. Do I get a degree when this is over? Do I get some kind of certificate, you know, in education or something?
Some people want a sticker, but
Yeah, you know we can help you with that, you know, as such. This has been amazing. You know, I'm just grateful for the work you're doing. I'm grateful for Outright. I want to figure out how we can continue to support you. Like to find a way for you to work with us to help us be better at what we do, because our service is designed to identify folks and people in need, youth in need of help. We're about that connection, helping identify information that someone can say, "Hey, are you okay? You know, is everything okay?" And I think that there's a natural fit for the ongoing, you know, partnership, relationship, whatever it looks like. I just think it's good stuff.
Well, we've got a fire truck pull coming up in September.
We missed last year's, I think. We were in last year's, but I don't think we won last year. So I think I have to write
exactly.
I was
going to say you're a tech company, so
yeah,
a bunch of nerds.
Totally.
I don't
know
if you can pull a fire truck.
But look at me. I can pull, like, you know, I'm strong. I can pull strong, you know, big things. I was built for that, you know. As I say, my ancestors were built for building things, right? Is that how that goes?
Yeah.
It's good. Okay, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. You're awesome. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Social Sessions. Subscribe to our channel today and stay tuned for more.